here, so I was glad to see that. A little less support for the Cantharos acinis clade here. There are a couple of things you may notice on this tree that I will point out. One of the issues was that my outgroup, Europlatos acinis, was pulled into the Sicinis clade, and it actually came out as a sister taxon to Sicinis championi. This was because there were several characters that were shared by both taxa in the initial matrix, and I wasn't able to get very good resolution between those two species. But if you kind of closely evaluate your Europlatos acinis, there are some very distinct characters that would support that it is a distinct genus and not simply a part of Sicinis. Another thing that was kind of interesting is that Cantharos acinis suffusus actually came out as a sister taxon to Sicinis instead of coming out in the Cantharos acinis clade. And I think the big issue here has to do with the tarsi having multiple setose patches. And Europlatos acinis and Sicinis championi also have this issue of multiply setose patches, as does the genus Diplectris. But Cantharos acinis suffusus is the only Cantharos acinis that has multiply setose patches. All of the other Cantharos acinis just have maybe one patch on each of their tarsi on their prothoracic, mesothoracic, metathoracic legs. When I next conducted just a revision, a cladistic analysis of Sicinis, I used Europlatos acinis as an outgroup, and I also conducted a separate cladistic analysis of Cantharos acinis, and I chose to use Metusa nosa as the outgroup rather than Diplectris. And that was because when I was doing the taxonomic analysis, I had removed several species from Sicinis and had placed them into Metusa nosa. And there was also the issue of the multiple setose patches again. That seems to just be a very plastic kind of homoplasious character. So in my analysis of the Sicinis clade, you can see that Europlatos Sicinis again came out right near Sicinis championi, and 100% of the time, you know, Sicinis championi came out basally to the rest of the Sicinis here. So just to look at some of the trends that might be going on, with Sicinis championi, this tends to be the oddball of Sicinis. Again, it is the only Sicinis that is found in North America. It appears to be endemic to southern Arizona. It has a few different features from the rest of the Sicinis, in that, again, it has multiple setose patches on its tarsi. It tends to have a longer head as well as a more elongate, more parallel pronotum. So it's possible that perhaps this species you know, maybe does not belong in Sicinis, but for now it does fit those other synapomorphies for that genus, so it remains. The next three are very interesting examples of some lysid mimics, particularly Lysiformis. You have another grouping of Suturalis, which again is the type species, Dilaticornis and Eximius. Eximius is the only Sicinis that tends to have two color variants in it. This does not appear to be a sexually dimorphic issue, just kind of two different colors there. The last three, Adonis, Bivitatus, Fasciatus, these are all kind of distinct, particularly Sicinis Adonis. It's a very pretty beetle, one of my personal favorites, with the orange and blue there. As for the Cantharos acinis, this is what the tree came out, and again, it was hard to get very good resolution in the tree at the species level, given the number of characters that I used. particularly if you look at some of the color patterns and that going on with the beetles. Some of these species are very distinct. They have some very distinct color patterns, particularly with Paraciloides has a bicolored elytra. Cephusus has two color forms, but again, this is the only species of Cantharocycines that has more than just one setose tarsal patch. It has at least two setose tarsal patches. The two on the bottom, Lineatocolus and Vitatopennis, both have distinct pronotal stripes, whereas the remaining Cantharocycines do not. All the rest of these Cantharocycines, except for Sinanje again has two color variants that is not a sexually dimorphic issue again. But even the color variation on the left, you'll notice that these remaining species are all orange and black. So this is the kind of most difficult group to try to separate looking at characters. There are some things to look at. Unfortunately, I did not have a lot of identified material. In a lot of cases, I was just working with the type species. So as more material is gained, hopefully we can get some better resolution among these different species and maybe look at some more distinct characteristics. So as for the big picture, this is really the first time that any phylogenetic analysis has been conducted within the Eetamaridae, and there were synapomorphies defined for both Cicinis and the new genus Cantharocycines. Keys for species to both genera were produced, and that will allow for identification of specimens in museums and private collections that are currently unidentified. I do have a lot of material that I gained just by asking for, unidentified neotropical Eetamaridae, and I'm in the process of trying to identify a lot of that material, and hopefully that will work out. As for the future of Eetamaridae, from here, I would like to examine more of the New World genera. I'd kind of gotten a start at doing that when looking at Cicinis and Diplectris and investigating some of these other outgroups. And it would certainly be handy to be able to produce more keys to species from any more of these groups. Kind of a long-term goal for me would be to revise Arnett's 1950 thesis that he had conducted on Nearctic Eetamaridae, since at least a few things have changed since then, and also to start to piece together some of these generic relationships within the Eetamarids. And from doing that, hopefully we can kind of build from the ground up and get a better understanding of tribal classifications as well. There's also the potential just for other areas of research, mainly like biochemical, looking at the cantharidin aspects of Eetamarids, since it's not known if all Eetamarids contain cantharidin. It's likely that they all do, but it's not certain. Maybe some of them have lost that ability. And I'm only one person, and I encourage any up-and-coming coleopterologists to join me in the Eetamarid family. Plenty of room for everybody. I have done basically one drop in the large Eetamarid bucket out there, and there's a lot I would love to do, but I won't be able to do it all myself. So, thank you.
Today I'm going to present some data with the use of a nematode for control of the filbert worm. But it's at this time I'd really like to acknowledge the authors, in which Uta Chambers is not here, Von Walton's not here, and Denny Brooks not here. So lo and behold, I was nominated to give the talk. And it does not mean the last is not least, though, because these other three, Denny's actually giving a talk in another room at this point. The other two are gone internationally on a trip, and they all performed the work, and I was only on the periphery. So I thought I should probably have this talk taped, because they owe me chocolate-covered roasted hazelnuts. You know, what's really cool about Oregon is they're noted for their high-quality nuts. And 5% of the world production is in the U.S., only 5%. 75% is in Turkey. And of that 5, 99% of production is in Oregon. 30,000 acres are grown all through what they call the Willamette Valley. And they can produce 3,000 pounds of nuts per acre. They're wonderful to eat. They can get around 85 cents per pound, and it's valued at $45 million in Oregon. It's one of the, it's the 15th most important commodity in Oregon. The first, you know, is nursery and greenhouses. Then there's dairy, there's cattle, dairy. And then I also do a lot of work in the grass seed industry. So that's the third in the commodities. There are many pests of hazelnuts, and as you can see, one of the key players is the filbert worm, and over a million, that's what it costs to actually control the filbert worm. Also really key too, it's listed down here, and they pay a little less, I say, in costs for controlling it are the aphids, and next year they should be presenting quite a bit of good information on those aphids. So I'm going to begin by telling you just a little bit about the life cycle. I'm going to start actually with the adult. That adult moth, and you can really distinguish it by those two gold bands, and it's a little bit over a centimeter large. And they fly really late spring and early summer, and you'll see them in search of, they'll have lots of pheromone traps out there, and that's really what determines when they're going to do their spray timing. There's also a degree day model they use as well. So with the moth, is flying about, mates, and starts laying eggs, and typically at the base of those clusters, right, and it's very soft and developing, and those eggs will hatch out, and the larvae then will just inhabit these nuts, and there's really zero tolerance, as you can see. So it's a stage that you really can't target for any control. And then the life cycle continues. They feed all summer, and you'll see some of these premature nuts dropping to the ground, and it's basically because there's actually a larvae, a filbert worm, inside of it. And in the winter, you'll see these trails of worms coming off the trees, and they will overwinter on the soil surface, maybe slightly below about a centimeter, or even in the debris and that duft of, you know, leaf litter and whatever's at the orchard floor. As you can see, up to 40% infestation if it's not treated. They overwinter too, and when those larvae drop, they go into this, it's a hibernaculum, and they're really hard to find in the soil. And that's kind of a key thing, and I'll talk about here in a minute. So some of the current management practices, as I told you, they do a lot of pheromone trapping. A lot of money goes into that, and it's really the early warning system letting you know that the moths are flying about, and that's really what you're targeting. And typically they have approximately two sprays that they put on after they first see those moths in a trap, as well as they'll do a second application 3 weeks later. And it's really a long emergence time. So it's kind of hit and miss. Sometimes you'll see them put a third one on because all of a sudden their peaks go up really high of moths. So you'll see another application going on. What they're using is a long list of pesticides. One in particular, it's their favorite, is a pyrethroid called Ambush. They're also looking into some of the insect growth regulators. But really their interest was to try to find some kind of a softer pesticide, in which they decided, well, let's try these entomopathogenic nematodes. And there are a few people who talked earlier today, you know, use of pistachios and the same type of treatment on the soil in the winter, when after harvest of those nuts, there's a lot of those hibernaculum and even larvae moving about on that floor. And why not try to cut down that generation to reduce the load for the following year in spring? So those people, those authors I told you about earlier, really did the work. They did some bioassays first. They did them in 2006 and 2007, as well as did field trials. And they were looking at three different species of nematodes, ones that were commercially available, mass-produced, as well as looking how do nematodes work, spraying them on a larvae versus something once they go into that hypernaculum. Is that a barrier to the nematode? And then they looked and transferred what they learned from that lab bioassay and then went into the field with it, choosing two of the nematodes and then one of the nematodes in 2007, and also looking at the different hibernation substrates, bare soil versus the use of the that substrate of leaves and